And we are back with show number 275 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, who really hates being locked out of things. I just need to get inside.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm a little hungry. I don't know if I'm going to go down to the bar or take this town over down the road.
That's right, and if I do, then it's probably not going to be Halifax, because I'm pretty much tired of being here. Yes, as you can probably tell, we are still a bit out of sorts here. I am still up in the Great White North of Canada, braving the snowstorm Nemo, as well as the fact that up here the beer is more potent and it comes in quarts, not pints. But be that as it may, we are still going to just shovel along here and do our usual bit. And that means we are going to be talking about Being Human, Lost Girl, and Spartacus. But first, Edmund, if you could please.
We will be talking about anything and everything that happens in these episodes, so we must warn you that you will be spoiled. But especially given the conditions, we have waited a while before we do so you've had time to catch up.
That's right. And unfortunately, because I do not have the ability to do so, we're not going to run the promos before we do this. It's going to be a little bit of an old school podcast in that respect, but we're going to go ahead and do the recaps as we usually do. So, we are talking about Being Human, Season 3, Episode 4, I'm So Lonesome I Could Die. Sally confronts Aiden over his reckless behavior, and Josh, in between trying to get hold of untainted blood, tags along when Nora visits her family. Is that the right one?
Yes.
Okay. For some reason, I thought that we had skipped something, but no.
No.
All right, yeah, this episode was, a little bit of a continuation, I guess, of what they did in the previous one, and I thought it was interesting that... I'll start first with Josh and Nora and all of that, what they went through, because that was just some of the most disturbing and uncomfortable plotting I've seen in a long time, and yet it was probably the most familiar plot twist that we've seen in a long time. Who doesn't have relatives or people they know whose family life is that just uncomfortable?
Oh yeah, no. I mean, at this point, I mean, Being Human is the undefeated champ of uncomfortable dinner, you know, uncomfortable dinner scenes. So, and you know, this one just adds to the long roster of these. So it's becoming.
I really thought it was a little bit over the top, though, even for the show. And I see the point they're making, and I realize that there are families that are near that, but it just seemed a little bit much.
Well, they were probably just trying to make sure that the knife was good and deep before they twisted. You know, you've got the dad that's just utterly apathetic in the most just, I don't even know if hostile is the word, but just...
Well, I spit out my drink when he says, you should, something like, what was it, check us. You should look at the mother or something
yeah.
like that.
Yes.
I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, that's a great example for the kids.
Yeah, I was like, oh wow, that's nice. Although, but the actor, I have to say, played it well when he was sitting out on the porch and Josh is talking to him, and you can almost see this look come over his face. I can't believe we're doing this.
Yeah.
he, you know, without a word, just the glance of his yeah. eye just really portrayed him well, you know.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Well, no, exactly. You know, sometimes acting is such a line delivery, but in other times you get those little jewels where it's a look, a glance, or a shrug that can say more than a page of dialogue. So it's nice to see it.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I mean, ironically, despite the situation that they're in, and you can just tell that Nora's beside herself having to expose them to this family situation that she almost wanted to forget. Kind of set aside and isolate from everything else in her life. As soon as RJ meets Erin, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
This is not going to end well.
Yeah.
and it was a moment of dread, especially when, you know, they're making eyes at each other, and then he shows up at the apartment
with a beer in hand. With half a case of beer in hand.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Not a whole, a half, because we know what's happened to the other half.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, she's the only one there. And the fact that she's underage had to have come across his mind. And he really didn't care.
No.
Which leaves Josh in the unfortunate situation where he's basically having to play dad. After having seen, of course, the absolute most perfect example of fatherhood.
Yes.
it was getting to the point where it's like, it's not just being human, it's being suburban human. And I didn't think it was over the top, but it was basically one of those situations where it's like, oh, I wish we almost could get back to that, to the vampire stuff again, because this is just too awkward and uncomfortable. And going up there and knocking on the door. Having to stop the advances of the half-drunken or totally drunken.
Yeah.
Well, and then he does. You know, she doesn't even back Josh against Nora either. She goes right for the other guy's side. Is like, you've known this guy for what, 5 minutes?
Yeah.
And she's already like, he's lying. I don't know. We were just talking. He came in. I was like, what? Even my mouth dropped open for that one. That she would so blatantly, you know, lie, but I guess indicative of her defense mechanisms.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, given the way the characters have been set up, I mean, it made sense. But yeah, but it was still, you know, even though Nora's not going to fall for that. It's, you know, it was just incredibly awkward, and also pointed up. I mean, you know, this is one of part of Josh's problem right now is the fact that, you know, no, he is the one who is just human. You know, he doesn't have any, you know, any inner wolf to pull on to, you know, help him out in those situations. And, you know, so, it, you know, to my mind, that was even, it's like I keep thinking down the road, you know, that they're going to set up some situation where, you know, Josh feels he needs to get it back. Of, you know, no, this is just one of the examples of, you know, yeah, we're having a little inner wolf might be a good thing. So, you know, we will have to see, but certainly, yeah, I mean, it did just point up that, you know, yeah, just being human isn't, you know, always what it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, and of course, we can't ignore Nora's little confession.
Mm-hmm.
That she killed Bryn, which, oh boy.
Yeah. Yeah.
No,
yeah,
Liam is not going to be happy with that.
No, not at all. But also, I mean, that was, I mean, yeah, I mean, in the midst of all that sort of, you know, horrific, you know, over the top family stuff, I mean, that scene was absolutely brilliantly acted. I mean, the you know, Sam Huntington and Kristen Hager just really knocked it out of the park, I thought, in that whole sequence, and especially putting it in the midst of all that, in a way kind of made sense as well, because, you know, yeah, when you're in that sort of extreme situation, you know, that's when those confessions can bubble to the surface, rather than when you're just at home, you know, going through your regular routine and trying to cover everything over. So, you know, yeah, and I mean, that was just one of the I thought stellar scenes between the main cast in this one. Certainly, Aiden and Sally had a couple of pretty significant and interesting heart-to-hearts in this one as well.
Oh, towards, you know, after, I guess it's her brother, you know, sort of spilled the beans,
mm-hmm.
About that Josh was going to ask, and they're having this, you know, they're dancing around the whole, you know, subject, and, you know, you see Josh start to realize that she knows, but he doesn't want to, you know, crack the ice either, so he starts dancing around, but at the same time, you know, saying that he wants that, even though she's saying, wait, and he's saying, I don't want to, it, mm-hmm. you know, we could do it. But he's not getting, unfortunately, any sort of positive response back for her. So now he's sort of backing off a little bit, which is a shame because Josh has been sort of a guy who's been pushing through things so much in this series. I'd hate to have him start backpedaling now.
Well, I actually like, to my mind, I read it that, you know, no, it's a sign of his evolution that he did push back a bit at the end. He didn't just acquiesce to it and say, oh, yeah, no, we shouldn't do that. You know, but then still got in his point at the end about, but we can, you know, so.
Yeah, I do see your point, but at the same time, it wasn't like he got down on any either.
No.
Well, that would have been just a little too far at that one point, but.
Yeah, that's true, I suppose. But but it still seemed like he backed up a little bit more than I wish he did.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, one thing, though, that came to mind, and Edmund, you were saying before that, is Josh going to feel that he needs to go back to being the wolf?
Mm-hmm.
And what came to my mind was that all of this is building to a particularly nasty situation where you know, Josh and Nora are going to maybe or maybe not find Erin again. It's fairly obvious what kind of situation she's going to find herself in.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm sure Nora could find her easily enough.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was thinking of that as well, and I'm trying to think to myself, you know, obviously they want to set up a situation where Josh can't kill the person who made him a wolf, or would make him a wolf again. So I'm thinking in the end it's going to have to be Nora.
Well, my thought was that it's not going to be her, but that Liam, once he finds out what happened, is going to want to make them suffer
right
before the end. In that first they're going to go after Erin, or he's going to go after Erin to take away their quote-unquote daughter, just as Nora did to him. And then I wouldn't be surprised if he decided to attack Josh to take that away from Nora as well. And that in the midst of, you know, defense or, you know, Nora coming to his rescue or however it might happen, that he would then be infected again,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a better term. And then, you know, the question is going to be, do they kill Liam? What do they do? Is that going to even work? Yeah, it's just a theory that I have, but I have a feeling that Liam is going to come back at the worst possible time.
Oh, absolutely. Because, yeah.
That's the way it works on being human. Because, of course, you know, then we've got, while all this is going on, we have Aiden basically going on this nihilistic self-destruction mode.
Yeah, I thought I switched to Lost Girl for a second there. Yeah. With the big parties.
What I found interesting is that he really doesn't care much about what Josh thinks of his influence on Erin. And he's kind of doesn't really care about himself. But, you know, he takes Sally out on the premise that he's helping her.
Yeah.
And it's basically so that he can go someplace kind of out of the way and find some food.
Yeah.
But it occurred to me that it's like, okay, so you're taking her into an area that she would never go usually. So she doesn't run into anybody that she knows. And then you basically leave her there.
Mm-hmm.
Fairly attractive young woman in not a really great part of town.
Yeah.
She's got to find her own way back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At best, she's not going to run into somebody she knows. At worst, oh boy, she's a ghost again.
Mm-hmm.
So that just kind of made me feel like, wow, he's gone from not just caring about his own fate, but in a way, he really just doesn't care about anybody. And Sally was completely justified in taking that stake and shoving it against his chest. So, yeah, that really was very uncomfortable, too, because I was just waiting for something bad to happen to Sally.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. I mean, it was sort of, you know, you could kind of tell from the clientele, but then when she actually got outside and it was like the row of bikes lined up. It's like, you know,
right.
Okay, it wasn't just that one guy. This really is a biker bar.
Not to mention, she should have been blitzed with the big margarita and the shots and everything like that. You figured she would have been a little bit more tipsy than she actually was. But
Well, maybe that's one of the side effects of reanimation. Your tolerance goes way up. But
fair enough, I can buy that. Although I have to say, as we were talking about, you mentioned, you know, Sally dying or Josh becoming a werewolf again. Is that where we see this whole season ending? Is almost a reset?
I would be surprised if they didn't. With one of them, you know?
Well, I mean, I understand that, and I'm not saying that it necessarily would go that way, but I would hope there'd be some differences. Like, maybe Sally doesn't need to be stuck in the house as much as she was, or, you know, things of that nature that they'll still, you know, give her a little mm-hmm. bit of roaming, or, you know, things of that nature, so we're not sort of really, literally reset so much as back in familiar territory, I guess might be a better way that I'd like to see it.
Yeah. Well, certainly with the way things are being set up with the Blood Witch, I mean, you know, there's any number of ways that you know, that side of things could you know, could play out. I mean, actually, I mean, with Sally, I mean, once they actually figure out what's going on with the people she's sending to her, you know, it might even be, again, I mean, just like with Josh, I mean, where they managed to justify it in terms of, you know, no, we need to shut this down, and this is the only way we can shut it down. And, you know, and there's also that other thread that's just hanging out there of where the witch tracked down Roy and what was she doing there. So, you know, mm-hmm. just, you know, in addition to Liam, I mean, there's even this, you know, I saw that as a possibility of, you know, no, she's somehow going to reanimate him. But so, We will see.
Right, and how would that mess with the whole thing with Josh and his humanity?
Yeah. Well, for that matter, yeah. I mean, that might be the way of rebooting Josh if his sire comes back.
Who knows what the rules are at that point? That's, I think that's really the thing, is that we don't know the rules for Sally coming back. We don't really know or understand the role for Josh becoming human again. So we don't know how permanent it can be. It's certainly when we talked about Josh, we talked about how ludicrous it actually was, the way that it was all described. So I don't know that I really bought this anyway. So,
well, I mean, permanent. I'd rather have them sort of reveal it in little bits. I don't need somebody to read from the magic book of old saying, you know, on the seventh day when you strike this person dead, you shall remain free until, you know, the 10th full moon, and then you might become one again or something like that. It's sort of like sometimes when they talk about science fiction, you have a show like Star Trek that details out everything, and then you have other shows that just sort of let it happen. And I'm fine with just letting it happen. And if they have to write something to make a good story and it slightly changes things, I'm good with that.
Well, I mean, from your perspective, since you basically were reading out of the book right then, it seems to me like it's just too familiar for you, so you'd feel like it was... It sounded like you... Yeah.
I think we're getting too self-referential. Anyway.
Maybe. All right, but certainly this was a good episode. I really enjoyed it, and I guess, let's see, what did I wind up giving this one? I think I give it an 8 again, because I liked a lot of the implications of it, and certainly it was very uncomfortable, and that's always a good thing when it comes to this kind of drama. How about you, Edmund? What would you give it?
Yeah, no, I'm good with an 8 as well. I mean, it was a good, solid episode. Lots of, you say, good implications, a good setup for stuff. But I'll reserve the higher marks for if I hope when they pay off some of this stuff they're setting up.
Gosh, absolutely. I usually like to be a little bit of the anti-voice or the opposite voice, but I think I'm going to stick with an 8 as well. As you said, it worked really well. There were a lot of implications, you know, for Josh and Nora, even Aiden, and even Sally. We didn't talk about it much, but she had a little bit of development at the end, which is sort of promising. So I'll go with an 8. The only thing that holds me back probably was the way that they handled, I forget her name, but the younger girl, werewolf. It's something in it just seemed unconvincing to me. It might have been the actress herself, but so I'll have to hold back full honors and stick with an 8.
Absolutely. Okay. So that being said and done, we are going to go ahead and move on to, appropriately enough for a stay here in Canada, Lost Girl. And Edmund, if you could maybe give the recap for it.
Sure. This is Lost Girl, Season 3, Episode 4, Fade to Black. Bo goes undercover to get to the bottom of why people believe that they... This is a terribly written recap.
Together, yeah, I know.
Bo goes undercover to get to the bottom of people believing that they have become the heroes of their childhood dreams with fatal consequences. And no, fatal was not spelled F-A-E, but anyway.
Yeah, well, it sounds like that the description was written by somebody for whom English is a fourth language.
Yes.
But setting that aside.
Yeah, I was trying to edit it on the fly, but there was just too much there to try and correct.
Yeah. All right, so let's see. Edmund, why don't you go ahead and get us started on this one?
Sure. Well, this... We have once again had what's becoming the standard cold open of Bo and Lauren making out, which was essentially, as it turns out, it's setting up the fact that Bo is really trying to be monogamous, and so is not basically is not getting that lovely sexual healing that she needs all the time. that was the major underlying sort of, you know, through plot, relating back to previous episodes. I mean, the actual case was, to my mind, very, very run of the mill Lost Girl. You had these people who are trying to, you know, who are all going to this very new agey clinic. They're winding up trying to reenact you know, these, you know, childhood dreams. The opening is with a guy trying to, who wants to be Philip Petit, the guy who tightrope walked between the World Trade Center towers. You know, so of course he's set up this lovely springy rope, which he immediately falls off of. You know, that actual case itself, I mean, where they have basically Dyson and Tamsin, or well, it's really, Tamsin isn't really going along with this as usual. Dyson decides to send Bo in as to pretend to be a therapist. Even that decision, it was like, well, why not send her in to try and be a patient the way Dyson does, you know, although I guess we see how that works out. Although I was amused that I think Gary may have commented on at one point that, you know, that yes, we did actually finally get Tamsin commenting on whether Dyson was going to remove his shirt or not. And of course he does, tries to realize his childhood dream of being a griffin and flying off of that same rooftop that we had earlier. Yeah, the actual tracking down of the villain, it just felt very, very pedestrian. I mean, it was sort of like the moment we found out the cat was referred to as one of the doctors, and just the way they shot the cat, it was like, you know, I knew, you know, that was what it was going to be, and then it didn't help, and the actual doctor showed up, and so it was so obviously a charlatan.
I've said cats were evil for a long time, and this episode just helped to prove
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly. And
I'm well aware of the fact that my cats would happily throw me off of a roof if it was to their best interest or entertainment.
Yes, I've got one glaring at me right now as I'm saying this, so you know, hopefully I'll make it to the end of the episode. The thing that really sort of got crystallized for me in this episode, and it was something I'd been thinking about, and then they actually just gave the perfect example right here, was, I'm certainly no prude, and as much as I love all the sexy action in Lost Girl, it really got pointed out to me in this episode that that part of what they seem to be doing this season just really fits the definition of gratuitous, where this whole thing of where every
that's
episode,
a lot for this to say for this show.
But in this episode we had the perfect example of what I felt has been missing, where, you know, yes, we have, you know, it's like, you know, this thing, we've now had like two out of the four episodes has to open with the two of them making out, with Bo and Lauren making out. But then we got back to the part that I actually liked from particularly the first season of, you know, Dyson, basically saying, look, you know, you're too weak. You need this, you know, no strings attached. You know, let's make out and get you healed. Which was getting back to, you know, where, you know, yes, you had the sexy action in the first season, you know, but it was like they were actually putting it in more of a context rather than just, you know, boom, we're going to have people making out. And I feel like that's what's been missing is, making it more organic and more, you know, part of the action, and have, you know, actual, you know, real, you know, reasons and emotions behind it. And it was kind of nice to get back to, and also the whole thing of, you know, the fact that this has been going on and with no, you know, sort of no reminders to the audience, because, you know, yes, not everybody's been following it for the last two seasons, you know, about why just being with Lauren could be problematic for her. They finally brought it up this episode. But even then, I mean, I'm starting to feel like there's some of the same problems from season two are creeping into this season, because we had the whole, you know, big, you know, shock, you know, shocking close of that episode, you know, where Bo just, you know, sucks that guy dry. And, you know, and then this comes up, you know, where, oh, no, I'm being monogamous, you know, and I don't know if you know, without even really any implication or reminder of, you know, that, yes, maybe that's partially because there's this dark side creeping up, and, you know, and that she's, you know, she's trying to stay away from, you know, sort of, you know, unleashing her succubus because she's afraid she can't control it anymore. You know, so it's like, you know, they're just sort of throwing stuff out there, and they're not doing a good job of sort of tying the threads together.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things for me was that, as you said, we've got the stuff with Bo and Lauren. If they were going to play up the fact that she is not enough for her, you know, from a pure energy level situation, right, then that seems to me like it's a perfect metaphor for Bo being a succubus and needing maybe more than a monogamous relationship can give on all levels.
Yeah.
And she's playing a couples therapist.
Yes.
Why did they not make some attempt to make her faux, you know, her cover identity somehow play into this whole question of her own personal life?
Mm-hmm.
And it never did. They didn't engage together.
Well, no. I mean, quite the opposite. Instead, it was more, you know, Lauren getting snippy with her about, you know, oh, you know, you don't really have any qualifications to do this.
Or even if it would have been sort of a self-check, like as she's describing something to one of the people she's listening to, if she, like, you know, turned her head to the side and said, "Hey," or, you know, like a moment of self-realization. We didn't even get that out of it. So yeah, no, I agree. It was definitely a lost opportunity for writing to bring it to her attention. But you know, even that being said, we are getting a little bit of that. You know, Tamsin, I like to think of almost as like the anti-Kenzie. She's able to, you know, sort of make the jabs against, I guess, the show in general, as opposed to just individual characters. Like, you know, as you said, when Dyson talks about taking her shirt off, or, "Oh, your girlfriend's waiting for you," or something like that. You know, back to Dyson too. She's able to, I think, voice some of the viewers' opinions into the show for us, which it's nice to see that reaction when we might be saying it to ourselves off screen. She's actually doing it on screen for us.
Mm. The one problem that I had with Tamsin, I mean, she's great. I like her as an addition to the show. It kind of constantly undercuts some of the seriousness, and certainly we could use that. You know, but while we're kind of complaining about the fact that they are skimping on the plot, so a lot of the stuff between Bo and Lauren feels like pandering, which you never want to feel that way, especially when they were doing such a good job of normalizing same-sex relationships in the first two seasons, to now make it seem like they're playing up the salacious side of things, to almost fetishize that. It's really not fair to that portion of the audience. But then, on top of that, they don't even feel like they're putting an effort into the big climax of the episode, because the cat turns into this creature.
Yeah.
The camera then intentionally does not show what they're looking at.
Yes.
And instead shows from the point of view of the creature. And you've got Tamsin pulling open her coat, having weapons all over the place, and she makes this lame movement with this knife. And it, like, flies at the camera, and then it's over.
Yes.
I mean, really? Are you kidding? That's the end? That's almost as bad as that the climax of that one episode of Babylon 5 with the energy monster. I mean, it's...
Well, also, I don't think we ever saw Tamsin with all those weapons ever before, to have her, like, pop open, you know, her coat and see, like, you know, 20 different types of bladed weapons. It wasn't like we've ever seen her... Matter of fact, I don't think we've ever seen her really with a bladed weapon before. Now we know she's packing, like, 20 at any given moment. So it seemed a bit of a cop-out, I agree. The only thing they didn't cop out on, I think, was the ending. When Bo and Lauren were actually talking, I thought that did seem like a very nice scene, albeit what they're discussing was a bit, you know, still a bit salacious, per se.
Yeah, to me, the one thing that was maybe the saving grace of this episode was everything that was happening with Kenzie. Because I did think that was fairly interesting in terms of Hale and the whole, you better, you know, Trick going in there and saying, "You better start acting like the Asher, or I'm not going to support you anymore," basically.
Yeah.
Well,
and
you see,
and
I had
go ahead. No. I'm wondering if you're going to say the same thing.
I was just saying, I had a real problem with that, actually. And I mean, Kenzie has been such an outspoken person who will step in the middle of any situation and tell you what she's thinking, whether you want to hear it or not. And to have her basically in these dire straits with not knowing what the Norn did to her arm, and her actively seeking help to so sort of not just go come right out to Hale and ask him after they've traded all these other kind of stories, she's pretended to be his girlfriend, they've kissed and all this other stuff, that she can't approach him when she actually needs serious help. It rang very false to me. I just I couldn't see the character that we've come to know be so complacent and quiet when she has an immediate concern like that. She's been much more active prior to this.
Yeah, that's where I was going with it, is that if there was one issue I had, even in this episode with that, the one thing that I really liked about the episode, it's that Kenzie's acting like she's being betrayed by Hale because she, quote, needs help, but why was she dancing around it as much as she was?
Right.
Yeah, I would think really she'd rip that thing off and wave it, put it right up to his nose. Hey, you know, what can you do about this?
Yeah, I mean, I can kind of understand that she's been holding off because she was kind of doing that usual human thing of hoping that it would just go away if she ignored it. But if it was getting that bad, why didn't she just say something to someone? I mean, yeah, it just doesn't make sense to me. And if it's something that's Fae-related, I'm surprised that nobody noticed something was going on with her in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, and in a way, I mean, what got to me more about it was, I mean, the way they were playing the whole thing with Hale and him being so caught up with being the Ash, you know, and then getting the advice to, you know, clamp it all down. That, to some extent, I mean, that part of it, I could understand, but what I didn't understand, yeah, I mean, is, you know, then Kenzie, you know, turning around, you know, just walking into the bar and, you know, and tearing it off and showing Trigg, you know, I mean, hell, Trigg's the one with all the, you know, with all the books and the knowledge about what all this stuff is and, you know, saying, look what I got. But, so yeah, I mean, I agree that part just doesn't jive with what we know about Kenzie.
Right. And for all we know, I mean, that could turn out to be a plot point, but for right now, it does seem a little off. So Bronze Thumb gave this one a 7 out of 10. I'm between a 6 and a 7 myself.
Mm-hmm. And oh, I'm at a 6.
I'm actually going to go with a 6 as well. Gary.
Yeah.
How about you, Edmund?
Yeah, no,
go ahead, Gary, give your
Yeah.
I give it a 6, and like I said, there's major issues with this. The only thing I'm possibly thinking, and maybe I'm being too ingenious for the writers, but that they are sort of writing Bo this way for some plot point that's going to come further down the down the season in a few episodes, that there's a reason that she's actually acting this way, and above and beyond poor writing. So that's sort of what I'm holding out hope for, but I'm not holding out that much hope. Because we found this writing to be inconsistent, pretty much every season so far. They've had up episodes, and they've had episodes that have sunk to high heaven. It's rarely been a consistent show.
Yeah. Edmund, how about you?
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you on a 6 as well. I mean, there's just too much where they just the scripts just seem to be flailing a little bit again, and you know, I'm not getting that sense of them really having a clear idea of where they want to go, and you know, if they even have an idea of how or where to bring all this together. So I mean, feeling a little less of the love for Lost Girl, but I'd love to say I'm hoping that they'll get it together again, but past experiences know we're probably going to be in for another wild ride.
Another rough patch.
Yeah.
Well, that's unfortunate, but there we are. Okay, so moving on, we can talk a little bit about, yes, Spartacus, War of the Damned. And Gary, why don't you go ahead and give the recap this time?
Sure, absolutely. We're talking about Spartacus, War of the Damned, I still call it season 3, I guess, even regardless of subtitles. Episode 2. Spartacus leads a daring assault to provide food and shelter for his people. Crassus, on the other hand, is building a fearsome army and receives an unexpected visitor. I'm still trying to get a handle on this show. I've mainstreamed the first two and, I guess, a half seasons, you might want to call it, and I have to say, so far, season 3 has let me down. It's been quite formulaic. I don't feel that the characters are really building any depth. And even the special effects and blue screen even seem to be lacking this season around. I'm not sure if budgets were cut, new people are into it. So I'm having a hard time getting into this new season, if you will. What do you guys think?
Devin, how about you?
I guess I'm kind of feeling like it. I mean, it's taking a little bit of time to get going. You know, it's not it's not like that beginning of last season. You know, where just you know the rebellion itself was kind of in disarray and trying to find its way. But you know, but we're kind of dealing with this. You know, it's setup time again. I've still been enjoying it. You know, it's. And certainly, I mean, in terms of the Roman side of things, having Julius Caesar come in as this sort of, you know, rock star bad boy was, you know, I thought a lovely little twist. You know, certainly not, you know, not what you expect from the more conventional depictions of him over the years. You know, and then, you know, yeah, I mean, some of the setup there was really working for me. I mean, Caesar coming in and then Crassus at the end, yes, giving the nod to his son, you know, all the tension that, you know, that's going to bring down the line. Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things where, I mean, the whole taking of the city, I mean, as I was watching it, I think I was getting caught up in it, but hearing Gary's points, it, you know, yeah, I mean, I do think that, you know, there is a little bit of again, where as opposed to the previous seasons where, you know, we really get to know these people more, you know, it's all being a little quick, and, you know, so it's feeling, if anything, you know, kind of a little bit more like the very early episodes where, you know, the Romans in particular, you know, I mean, literally, you know, I mean, you're not getting to know them because we're just seeing them and then they're killing them all off. So, you know, perhaps as they settle into the city and they have time to, you know, sort of get back to some of the character development that we're more used to, you know, I think things may deepen a little bit. But, yeah, for now, it's, you know, sort of lots of moving the pieces around and not as much getting to know the pieces.
It's kind of funny because I think I disagree a little bit on this with you guys, because I feel like this is still the natural way for them to deal with things since deciding to make that big jump
right
in time. And I think maybe that might be some of the disconnect that's going on here, but I think they're dealing with a lot of the problems that they would need to be dealing with. They've been running pretty strong, gathering more and more followers, but sooner or later they're going to come to a critical mass, mm-hmm. and they're going to need to have some kind of support system, not just in terms of food, but, you know, shelter and everything else. Mm-hmm. And as they said right from the start, they don't really know what to do next. They, you know, Spartacus is thinking about eventually maybe going at Rome, but they've been just harried by one Roman commander after another, and yes, they've had success, but they are still rebels on the run. And, you know, the only solution right now is to take a city worth of resources. At the same time, when you do that, there are inevitable drawbacks, and one of them is that by the end of this episode, they are in a very centralized location. They can be found and therefore harried at that location. But getting in is, of course, difficult, and more difficult than just saying, oh, let's go take the city. Mm-hmm. You have to find a way to do that. So we start looking at how these rebels are being perceived within Roman society. And that's where this city comes in. You've got, you know, the inevitable layers of status, the class conflicts that, you know, because you've got people that are in the town that are willing to let Spartacus come in and do what they want to do. But then you've got the people at the very top, the patricians, that are completely against Spartacus because he wants to topple down the order that keeps them at the top. And then you have the people in the middle. And inevitably, the people in the middle are the ones that, as things progress with the rebels coming into the town, are the ones that are getting slaughtered indiscriminately. So I found that interesting, that they were building up all of this about, oh, what are we going to do when we get in there? And finally, despite Spartacus and his clear anger towards the Romans, I get the feeling that by the end of this episode, he was finally understanding that he had an army that was largely just barely in his control. And it was taking us from where we were in the premiere, where you know, they were pretty much listening to what he had to say, and he wasn't getting much in terms of resistance or disciplinary problems. But now we see that. And contrasting that, then, with Caesar and the fact that, like you said, Edmund, Caesar is completely not who you expect him to be. He's cocky, arrogant, twisted, deviant, and ambitious as all hell. So, I mean, we're seeing Caesar before he actually has the power that he wants. So, it is going to cause a problem between him and Tiberius. And I'm sure that Tiberius is then going to be prompted to do things that he really shouldn't in order to try to get his father's favor over Caesar. But, you know, all these little details I thought were really interesting. And I feel like they gave us more in terms of the inner workings of the rebellion than they gave us in the premiere. In the premiere, we all said that Crassus was the standout character that really brought it up to an 8. But I thought that this was more balanced. And maybe it's because I kind of liked seeing a Caesar that wasn't this stately, you know, under control, strategic mastermind, but instead the young soldier who needs to learn a lot of those things.
Yeah, no. I mean, I agree that the Roman stuff was the stuff that I did find much more compelling again. And my bigger issue, just, you know, and I mean you're right in terms of what they were presenting about the situation made sense in terms of you know, the challenges the rebellion is facing, but it was just compared to, you know, the sort of amount of depth and background that we got in Battiatus's Ludus, you know, and around the arena in the, you know, the first two series, there's any way around it, because, you know, no, I mean, they had a city, they were coming to take it, so, you know, it's not like you had a chance to provide a lot of background, but it just felt a little more schematic on that side. And while I agree that, you know, yeah, it was, you know, yes, I mean, what it was presenting was, you know, yes, all, I mean, all good develop, you know, good development for what they were having to overcome. Just you know, I still got that sense of, you know, no, this, you know, this, you know, we're, you know, I'm looking forward to things settling down now and getting more of the background and more of the character stuff that you know, I think is really their strength. And you know, that the rebellion side of things, and, you know, was, you know, no, this is going to be a battle, this is going to be, you know, lots of over the top violence as the slaves, you know, got to run riot over the patricians. And you know, I'm much more interested now in the aftermath and how they handle the both how the rebellion reacts to being in one place, and also how they're going to deal with the prisoners. And you know, it's certainly the relationship they were building between Spartacus and you know, the wife of the patrician grain holder. So you know, yeah, it's you know, I agree, this is stuff that was necessary to set things up, but you know, I'm still looking forward more to what they start developing on that side of things. And and on the Roman side, of course, we will get to see that huge phalanx of forces moving down the road, and inevitable command tensions, which will be lots of fun.
Yeah, given what you guys say, I can see your point. I mean, I've been used to a small sort of small group of actors with a army background, and at the moment, the army really seems to be taking the forefront of the action. And maybe it's just that difference in style that I have to get used to for the moment.
Mm. Well, I gave this one an 8 out of 10 because I still liked it quite a bit. But how about you, Gary? What would you give it?
Probably around a 6, but although, I mean, when I say 6, 5 means it wasn't junk. 6 means there was redeeming things to it, but I still feel this show has this season has a way to go before I can go much higher. I think it can, but it's not there yet.
Okay. And Edmund, how about you?
And I will go right in between you with a 7. Yeah, because I was fine with the Rome stuff, not as fine with the city stuff. Still good, but okay. But yeah, keeps it at a 7.
Okay. And Gary, I mean, before we wrap this up, I just was curious. I mean, you basically caught up with Spartacus in what I think we could call record time.
Well, there's a funny story to go along with that.
I imagine there is.
I'll keep it short though. My wife actually had started watching the first episode or two, and I was like, oh, that's odd, because we don't subscribe to Showtime, and I'm not getting it through any illicit means. And so my wife had informed me that, oh, they were running a preview special, and they typically do this on my cable system. You know, every maybe month or two, they'll throw one of the premium channels up for a weekend or something, sort of to tease you with it.
Oh, yeah.
So after about a week, we still had it on. I said, that's odd. They don't usually run it for more than, maybe 5 days, and typically it's only for like a weekend or an extended weekend. And so my wife said, I don't know. It was like, well, you better hurry up. We better hurry up and speed through Spartacus while we...
Uh-oh.
Showtime must have gotten word.
That's right. Oh, well.
Well, I think he's still there, but the audio has gotten extremely... There he goes. Okay.
Anyway, where was I?
You were just at the point where it hadn't gone off after the 5 days.
Oh, and after week two, we still had it. And at that point, my wife informed me that she had called our cable company about a service issue, and they offered to give it to her for $10 a month for the next 6 months for free. So we did not need to speak, not for free, for $10 a month. So we did not need to speed through it at the rate which we did, and I found out we are now Showtime subscribers as well.
Very nice.
Which is good, and certainly that gave you the opportunity to catch up and see everything that Spartacus is able to offer you.
Yes, and I've also caught up on Homeland as well.
Oh.
Ah, excellent.
And I still don't want to get into Dexter. I think I'd have nightmares. So, but anyway. But.
Also, yeah, that is also much more of a commitment, too. So.
Yeah, I would say so.
So I would expect that anytime soon, but both stars with Spartacus, which we now have, and Showtime, which we now have been entertaining, and I can see some of the praises that you give to both shows are reasonably well deserved.
Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there is also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Misuse of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...